Good morning, everybody. I'm Leslie Liljenberg, Chair of the Board. Today is March 27, 2026, and the time is 9 a.m. I now call to order this meeting of the Board of Directors of the Surplus Line Stamping Office of Texas. This meeting is being held in person at the Surplus Line Stamping Office of Texas, 1601 East Pflugerville Parkway, Suite 3301, Pflugerville, Texas, 78660. Board members were notified of this board meeting on March 4th, 2026. The Deputy Commissioner of the Financial Regulation Division of the Texas Department of Insurance or the Deputy Commissioner's Delegate were notified of this meeting March 16th, 2026, in accordance with Section 2C2 of the SLTX Plan of Operation. Notice of this meeting was published on March 20th, 2026, in accordance with Chapter 551 of the Texas Government Code. A conference call-in number was provided to members of the public for this meeting. I will now call the roll to confirm which board members are participating in today's meeting. Jeff Klein.
Present.
Dave Lawrence.
Here.
Peter Harrison. Yeah. Okay. Leah Bennett.
Here.
Ryan Bridges.
Here.
Jim Bishop.
Here.
Quorum of five or more members is present pursuant to Texas Government Code Section 551. 125B2 and Plan of Operations Section 2C6. The following stamping office management staff, council, consultants, and liaisons are present. Please affirm your attendance for the record when I call your name. Greg Brandon, Executive Director.
Here.
Toby Pick, Director of Policy Intake and Analysis.
Here.
Shalonda Stone, Director of Information and Technology Services.
Here.
Ronnie Ford, Director of Finance.
Present.
Denise Mosquito, Director of Human Resources.
Here.
Jeff McWirt and Michael Norrid, General Counsel.
Here. Here.
Denise, will you please identify the additional stamping office staff members participating via Teams?
Yes. Teams, we have Dalton Moore, Christian Porter, Robin Porter, and Yuva Dahal.
Thank you.
And present in the conference room is Marisa Gomez and Christian Robinson.
Okay. Are there any liaisons or consultants attending? I know we have Nikki Mullins of Calhoun, Thompson, and Matza.
Present.
And is Mr. Clark Thompson of Calhoun, Thompson, and Matza. Alex Bohan.
Here.
Did I say that right?
Bohan. Close enough.
Are there any representatives of TSLA?
Yes, Paul Rainey.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Rainey. Are any representatives of the Texas Department of Insurance, the Texas Comptroller, or legislative offices attending in person or by telephone?
Yes, Stephanie Caparelli.
David Dodd, Office of Financial Counsel.
Caitlin Bain.
Everybody? All right. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Before we get started, I have a few housekeeping item reminders. Antitrust activity or discussion are prohibited at all stamping office functions. This prohibition includes the exchange of information concerning individual company rates, coverages, market practices, claim settlement practices, expenses, or any other competitive aspect of an individual company's operation. We will not have a public comment session. Public and media attendees listening by telephone should mute their lines at all times. Representatives of state agencies and members of the public are welcome to observe or record this board meeting, but please refrain from asking questions or interjecting comments during the board's deliberations. The state agency personnel present may be asked questions about their agency's policies if those questions relate to an agenda item. Members, council, and staff should identify themselves by full name when speaking. Please mute your microphone or telephone when not speaking. So agenda item number two, discussion and appropriate approval of December 12th, 2025 meeting minutes. Everyone was provided a copy of the December 12th, 2025 meeting minutes. Are there any corrections? Further discussion? Being no further discussion, do we have a motion to approve the December 12, 2025 meeting?
Also moved, Jeff Klein.
Second.
Our second, sorry.
Second.
Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Ayes have it, and motion passes. Agenda item three, the F&A committee report. I'm going to turn this over at this time. This agenda item is to discussion and appropriate action of the annual financial audit review. At this time, I will open the floor to Ms. Ronnie Ford, Director of Finance, and Nikki Mullins of Calhoun, Thompson & Matza, LLP, to present the agenda item.
I'm going to turn it over to you.
And clerk.
Want me to go over what I did yesterday?
Yes, sir. Please.
No. Well, good morning, everyone. You should have two documents issued by my firm, the audit wrap-up letter and the audited financial statements. And I'm going to go over the wrap-up letter. On page one, we talk about the status of the audit. We've completed our audit. Our audit was conducted in accordance with auditing standards accepted in the USA. Our opinion, dated May 24th, 2026, was unmodified, and that's the best type of it. All records and information that we've requested were freely available to us. Management and other company personnel provided full cooperation. And pages two and three, we talk about the results of the audit. Accounting policies. The company's significant accounting practices and policies are included in the financial statement. These accounting practices and policies are appropriate. They comply with the U.S. GAAP. They were consistently applied, and they are adequately described in the summary of significant accounting policies in the financial statements. Also, there were no changes in significant accounting policies and practices during 2025. Significant estimates. Significant estimates are disclosed in the summary of significant accounting policies and the notes to the financial statements. And even did not make any significant changes to these processes or assumptions used to develop significant accounting estimates in 2025. On page three, we talk about corrected and uncorrected misstatements. There were four corrected misstatements as a result of the audit. And the first three are consistent with prior years. They're basically reclassification entries. They didn't change assets or net position. And the fourth one is, again, it's a reclassification. It's unique this year, but it was just reclassifying investments by type. And again, it didn't affect total investment, it did not affect total assets or net position. And there were no uncorrected misstatements as a result of the audit. So everything that, all the misstatements were booked. On page four, we talk about internal controls for financial reporting. In planning and performing our audit, considered the company's internal control and financial reporting as a basis for designing our audit procedures, but not for the purpose of expressing an opinion on the effectiveness of internal controls, and that's consistent with this type of engagement. We then present a definition of each type of control and efficiency on page. At the bottom of page four, we note that we didn't note any material weaknesses during the audit. Pages five and six, we talk about other required communications to those charged with governance. Governance with management during the audit. We're not aware of any instances where management consulted with other independent accountants during the year. Prior to being retained as auditors, there were no major accounting issues of concern discussed with. We encountered no significant difficulties during the audit. We received a representation letter from management, which management has or will provide to you. There were no other issues arising from the audit that we consider significant to those charged with governance. And there were no discussions with management concerning alternative accounting. Page seven, we talk about independence. And in our engagement letter dated July 17th, 2025, and describe our responsibilities in accordance with standards and certain written regard to independence. This letter also stipulates the responsibilities of the company with respect to independence and agreed to by the company. So for further information about independence, for your engagement. And lastly, I'm not going to go over the financial statements. We've already seen these numbers and went over the adjustments with you. So unless someone has a question, please find that.
Thank you so much. Is there any further discussion or any other questions? Ms. Ford, do you have a recommendation for the board at this time? Do we have a motion to approve the 2025 audit as presented? Second?
I'll second.
Jim Bishop, second. Thank you, Ms. Ford. Agenda item 3B, discussion and appropriate action, 2026 finance year-to-date update, reserve balance update, investment and cash management policy annual review. We will now discuss agenda item 3B. Ms. Ford, Mr. Alex Behun of Frost Bank, the floor is yours.
Put it over to Alex to present the.
My name is Alex Behun. I work with Frost Bank. Appreciate you all letting me join you all today. I have the privilege of helping manage your cash reserve account, and we'll go over the investment policy just real quickly. The most important thing on here is the investment objectives of the organization. The first one being preservation of capital. Second, providing sufficient liquidity to meet routine and projected cash requirements. And the third is to achieve a rate of return adequate for the organization's operations and offset the impact. As far as investment restrictions, I'll reaffirm those here in a moment. We'll touch on those again. As far as the investment types, in the account, we use a variety of different investments. First being certificates of deposit. One of the main things about our CD portfolio within the account is making sure that every single one of them remains FDIC insured. So we do that by making sure that each deposit we purchase of a bank under the $200,000 limit. And because of that, we do have quite a large portfolio of CDs. We also invest in fixed income securities. We own individual domestic fixed income. We also own fixed income through open-ended mutual funds. Equities are also an available option. Because the main objective is capital preservation and the second, liquidity, we don't have any equities in the portfolio at the moment, just due to the risk of investment loss. And third, or alternative investments, we also do not have any private equity or any sort of other alternative investments in the portfolio at the moment. And that doesn't really meet the liquidity requirement of the investment. Looking at the slides I provide, we'll just go over the reaffirm the investment restrictions of the portfolio. So in the portfolio, all the investments are publicly traded. All of our investments are US dollar denominated. No voting securities of any corporations around. No more than 10% of the portfolio is invested in any one corporation at cost. And no more than 25% of the portfolio is invested in any one industry at cost. I went over the current investment listings. As far as their weightings in the portfolio, currently half the portfolio is certificates of deposit. Again, we own 80 to 90 different deposits or certificates from different institutions, just to make sure that all of them remain FDIC insured. We do have 15% of the portfolio in US Treasury bills, Treasury notes. These don't have FDIC insurance, backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, which also backs the FDIC. So as far as safety is concerned, those fit the bill. And then we also own some individual corporate taxable domestic fixed income. Those have been maturing, and we've been reinvesting them into open-ended mutual funds. So that weighting has grown up slightly over the course of the last year. We have 35% of the portfolio in domestic fixed income owned through open-ended mutual funds.
Alex, I had a question while we're on that slide, if I may. Yes, Jeff Klein, the 10% and 25% thresholds, are those a requirement of statute or our plan of operation?
That's a great question. It's part of the investment policy. I didn't help create the investment policy. I just make sure that it's enforced.
It's consistent with the policy.
It's not in the plan of operation. This is truly just a policy guideline.
Okay. Thank you. You both.
Yes. Going to the next slide. It's just, you know, the most important thing, obviously, aside from preservation of capital and liquidity, is providing income to the organization. Looking here, I've calculated the estimated income that the portfolio will produce over the next 12 months. So just as a projection from this point in 2026 to February of 2027, the portfolio should produce roughly $1.3 million of just interest or dividend payments. If we look at principal maturities plus interest earned, the portfolio should have over $11 million either coming due or paid to you via interest payments and dividend payments. So as far as liquidity is concerned, we make sure it's a very liquid portfolio if you have any expenses. As you can see, we have over $11 million maturing in the next 12 months. Therefore, be able to provide that liquidity for you if needed. Last slide is just a current touch on current events. March always seems to be a hot month for geopolitical conflict. No different this time. With the main thing that affects y'all's portfolio isn't necessarily the stock market or what you see the S&P 500 doing on a day-to-day basis. It's really interest rates. Fed does with the Fed funds rate and also inflation. Inflation had been coming down quite a bit since rates were increased dramatically in 2022. We've seen a slow lowering of the Fed funds rate. Going into this year, we did expect a couple more cuts to that rate. However, with the ongoing conflict in Iran and the increased energy prices, it's caused an uptick in inflation recently. So February's numbers came back a little bit hotter than expected, and that's prior to all of these increased energy prices getting introduced to those calculations. So as far as interest rates go, I'm not sure how much lower they will go this year. If inflation does increase quite a bit, they could tick up. And in order to combat that in your portfolio, we make sure that we take a diversified approach to the duration. So as you can see, if rates do go up, we're going to have $11 million to reinvest into the new higher interest rates throughout this year. If interest rates stay the same or tick down, we do have longer dated maturities in the portfolio already. The goal is just to get a really high average yield in your portfolio despite broader economic climate. So interest rates being higher are good for y'all because that's how we produce income. Inflation, not so much, but we have flexibility to be able to handle that. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Alex. Appreciate that. Is there any further discussion or any questions on this item? Ms. Board, do you have a recommendation for the board at this time?
No recommendation.
Okay, thank you. Now we'll move on to agenda item 3C, discussion and appropriate action of the annual stamping fee analysis. Okay. So I'm going to turn the floor back over to you, Mrs. Ford.
I'm going to review the February 2026 actual versus budget. Start off with the stamping fee revenue is under budget, $228,800. Investment income is $7,500, 6% under what we budgeted for the month, and $30,500 due to the market decline. Operating expense is $115,706, which is 17% under for February, and $150,784 year to date. The next item is salaries and benefits, $97,031, 22% under budget for the month, and $189,790, 21% over budget year to date. This is mainly due to timing differences of the PTO accrued Preliminary budget monthly. Professional services is $11,713, which is 19% under budget for February, and $6,449, 6% year-to-date due to the timing of legal, audit, and lemon-like payments. Conferences and education is $1,628, 19% over budget for the month, $4,940, 31% under budget year-to-date due to timing of the budget. And entertainment is $613, which is 111% over budget for the month, $2,457, 63% under budget year to date due to the timing of budget expenses. This leads on to occupation and operation expenses is $4,677, 10% under budget for February, and $13,252 year to date. The administrative expense, $1,132% under budget, and $4,942 year-to-date. TIPS expense not used resulted in $3,394 saving for the month and $6,964 year-to-date. Operating income for February was $16,656 and loss of $289,685 year-to-date. This is less than budgeted income of $6,752 for the month and $120,662 year-to-date. This is primarily due to the timing difference of the PTO accrued in January budgeted monthly. And then the change in investment value increased by $76,708 in February and year-to-date by $47,014. Are there any questions on these items? If not, then I'll move on to the unrestricted reserve balance. Unrestricted undesignated funds reserve balance in 2026 was $32.8 million, which was 16.6 over the maximum for the year, which is 16.2 is our maximum amount. February year-to-date net loss was $242,671. Resulted in a fund balance of February the 28th of $32,530,085, which is $16.3 million over our current maximum. Any questions on the fund balance?
Okay. So if there are no further discussions or questions, Mrs. Ford, do you have a recommendation for the board at this time? Thank you very much. Now we'll move to agenda item 3C, discussion and appropriate action, the annual stamping fee analysis. I will now open the floor to Mr. Greg Brandon, Executive Director, and Mr. Christian Robbins.
Leslie, before we start, we're going to announce a few people who have joined since we started.
Yes, for the record, Ariel Rosario and Sharmila Suvedi from SLTX have joined the meeting via Teams.
So as you know, we have to go over the stamping fee annually, and Christian has put a lot of time and effort into analyzing the stamping fee. So I will turn it over to him and let him provide his presentation to you.
Thank you, everyone, for having me here today. And as Greg said, my name is Christian Robinson, and I am the Senior Data Analyst at SLTX. And full disclosure, there's a lot of numbers in this presentation, so I hope you all have had your coffee and feel awake. But today I'll be walking you through our 2026 stamping fee analysis, which is a comprehensive look at the adequacy of the current stamping fee rate for the goals of reducing reserves while maintaining financial stability. I'll also walk through what the data tells us about the current state of the market and what our options are going forward with respect to the stamping fee rate. And before I dive in, I do want to set an expectation up front that this year's analysis is different than usual and that it doesn't point to a single obvious course of action. So my intent today is to lay that out as transparently as possible, and I'm happy to take any questions at the end. Now, as always, it's important to ground this discussion in the plan of operation. So in section 1B7C, it instructs the board to recommend to the insurance commissioner a stamping fee rate as measured by premium, be charged on all surplus lines filings submitted to the stamping office. Now, that recommendation must be submitted within 30 days of the annual board meeting, and it must include whether the board is recommending to raise the fee, to lower the fee, or to take no action. And now, because of the state of our reserves, which Ronnie just presented to you, I did not consider the option of raising the fee, but I will discuss two different options for lowering the fee and then also keeping the stamping fee rate where it is. Now, equally important to the plan of operations guidance on the undesignated fund balance, the plan of operation also establishes that projected reserves excluding asset replacement funds not exceed 2 times the average audit expenses over the previous 5-year period. And should the reserve balance exceed that threshold as it is currently, then the plan of operation also requires that the board submit a written plan for reducing those reserves within a reasonable time frame, considering existing market conditions. And as we will see shortly, the reserve balance continues to exceed this maximum and by a meaningful margin. So this makes this analysis consequential. Now, before diving into the analysis itself, I want to give a picture of where things currently stand today. So as of the end of 2023, the undesignated fund balance was $32.7 million. And by the end of last year, it came in at $32.8 million. So roughly flat within that 2-year period. Now, over the same period, the maximum allowable fund balance has been increasing. So it stood at $12.5 million at the end of 2023, and it's at $16.2 million as of the end of last year. And on the slide, it notes that this was unaudited as of the time of me making this slide, but as of 10 minutes ago, this is now audited. So now those numbers are official. And now the gap between the actual balance and the maximum was approximately $20.2 million as of the end of 2023, and that has reduced in 2 consecutive years, to where as of the end of last year, the gap between the actual balance and the maximum balance is now $16.6 million. So we have made meaningful progress in reducing that gap, but it still does remain substantial. So the pace of that reduction is the central topic for today. And now first, I want to walk you through just the structure of what today's analysis is going to look like. So there's 3 primary levers that we consider that drive our reserve balance. So the first one being the revenue that we collect from stamping fees, and that's probably the largest lever. There's also the income that we generate from investments and operating expenses. So for each, I will provide a historical overview and then a future outlook. So with stamping fee revenue specifically, I will also offer a geographic comparison to other states and see where their stamping fee rates are currently. And I'll also present a break-even analysis. So from there, we'll look at updated projections and a scenario analysis at the end that models the different rate paths moving forward over the next 10-year period. Now, this slide shows the complete history of the stamping fee rate since the stamping office's inception. So one of the most notable observations is that on average, the rate has changed approximately every 3.5 years, and the current rate of 0.04% has been in effect since January 1st of 2024, meaning we are 2 years into the current rate cycle. So to give you some context, from 2007 to 2016, so that 10-year period, SLTX maintained a 0.06% rate for that full decade. And then in 2017, that rate was increased to 0.15% to help cover costs associated with what later became the Smart Development Project. And as the scope of that project changed, and at the same time, the surplus lines market in Texas entered a hard market with increasing premiums year over year, that rate was reduced to 0.075% effective 1-1 of 21. And then it was reduced again to the current rate effective January 1st of 24. Now, not only is the current stamping fee rate the lowest in Texas stamping office history, but it is also currently tied with Illinois and Minnesota for the lowest rate nationwide. And while Texas is currently tied for the lowest rate, Florida did announce a few weeks ago that they are planning to lower their stamping fee rate to 0.03% effective July 1st of this year. Now, I do want you to keep in mind that states don't compete on fees and each has its own unique market conditions and constraints that they have to consider. But just knowing where we stand provides perspective as we evaluate what our next step should be. Now, this is where I said there's going to be a lot of numbers. So this is probably the most numbers you'll see on a slide today. So I do want to walk through this carefully. The table shows the three levers that I discussed. So it shows stamping fee revenue over the last 3 years, as well as investment income and audited expenses. And there's also two rate figures in this table. So I have the stamping fee rate for each year and the break-even rate and the realized rate. So for this realized rate, I do want to define this because it's an important distinction with the stamping fee rate. So the realized rate is simply the total stamping fee revenue that was generated during that year divided by total premium. And this differs from the stamping fee rate because of how the stamping fee rate is applied to policy. The stamping fee rate applies on depending on when a policy is effective, not when it's actually reported to our office. So as an example, even though the stamping fee rate was lowered to 0.04% in 2024, a lot of the policies that were reported in the first half of the year in particular were 2023 policies, and so they were assessed the old 0.075% rate. And the longer that a rate is in effect, the more that the realized rate and the stamping fee rate should converge. And you can see that with the realized rate. So in 2024, the realized rate was 0.045, and last year it was 0.042%, so much closer to the actual rate. Now, the break-even rate is the rate at which SLTX would need to assess fees in order to exactly cover expenses each year through a combination of stamping fee revenue and investment income. So what you'll notice is that the break-even rate has been declining each year over the last 3 years. So in 2023, the break-even rate was 0.055%, and then last year it was 0.041%. And then even when you look earlier than 2023, the break-even rate has historically sat around 0.06%. So that declining trend in the break-even rate is meaningful, and it reflects a growing contribution of the investment income to our overall revenue picture, as well as a stabilizing of operating expenses over the same period. Now, looking back at the projections that were presented to the board last year for our stamping fee revenue, what actually occurred in 2025 aligned very strongly with what we projected for that period. So as you can see, the average month was projected to have $642,000 in stamping fee revenue, and the actual amount was $641,000. So this gives us confidence in our analysis and our modeling, and we'll see that later on when we forecast premium over the next 10 years. Now, this matters because the scenario analysis, like I said, that I'll present later on is built on the same projection methodology as this one. And when we can point to a track record of projections aligning closely with reality, it lends credibility to the forward-looking scenarios that we'll be evaluating later on. And of course, there is always the potential for unforeseen events, especially in the surplus lines market where everything is unique, but that's why updating these projections every year is so important. Now, this slide shows the trajectory of reported premium over time, and it tells an important story about where our market might be headed. So, as you can see, after several years of rapid double-digit premium growth in the early 2020s, driven by hard market conditions, we're now beginning to see that growth slow. So it is worth noting that premium decreases year over year are historically very rare. And when they do occur, they are consistently followed by subsequent increases in premium. So this context also matters for how we think about the stamping fee rate, because if premium continues to slow or temporarily reverses, history at least tells us that that trend is short-lived. Now, building a little bit on that premium discussion, this slide shows the direct impacts that the rate has had on stamping fee revenue. So after the revenue increase that we saw from those hard market conditions in 2023, the revenue has declined over the last few years due to those stamping fee rate changes. So I do want to point you to those vertical dashed lines that you see. Those are the rate changes. So the first one being when the stamping fee rate was reduced in 2021, and then the second line being when it was reduced in 2024. And I specifically want to draw your attention to the latter half of 2025, where revenue, especially over Q4 2025, was particularly soft and noticeably lower than prior quarters of that year. Now, if that trend continues into 2026, it will enable us to cut into those reserves more meaningfully. And now that we've talked a lot about the stamping fee revenue, I want to turn to investment income, which is the component of our financials that I would say has undergone the most meaningful transformation over the last few years. Now, historically, investment income was essentially a rounding error in our break-even analysis. And for the most part in our stamping office history, it was so immaterial that it wasn't even worth modeling separately. It might represent a few hundred thousand dollars here and there, but it didn't really move the needle on reserves in any way. However, that is no longer the case, as you can see. The combination of two factors has changed this picture significantly since 2022. The first being the sustained higher interest rate environment that took hold nationally. And the second is just the sheer volume of invested assets that SLTX holds as a result of those elevated reserve funds. Now, the result is that investment income has grown substantially from 0.7 million in 2023 to doubling about 1.4 million last year. Now, moving to the third lever, operating expenses, this chart illustrates the year-over-year variability in SLTX operating expenses. And there's a lot going on in this slide, so I do want to point out that the orange line that you see is the operating expenses for each year in total dollars. And the blue bars that you see is a year-over-year change of those dollars. The one thing that stands out immediately is how variable expenses are year to year. And this isn't an arbitrary fluctuation, but it reflects the reality of how SLTX has operated historically. So expenses tend to spike in years up with significant operational changes. So some notable examples are the period surrounding the smart development, where SLTX made substantial investments in technology infrastructure. And similarly, periods of intentional investment in employee compensation benefits show up as elevated years with operating expenses. Now, outside of those specific inflection points, the year-over-year changes in expenses are relatively contained, where they're often negative or only reflect modest growth. Now, that tells us that SLTX's underlying operational cost structure is relatively stable year to year outside of those specific inflection points. Now, understanding this pattern is important in the scenario analysis that I will be presenting later, in that even though each scenario assumes a steady growth rate into the future, in reality, the operating expenses are likely to fluctuate within that time frame. Now, this slide presents the scenario analysis for the fund balance. So this models three different growth rates over the next 5-year period for operating expenses at 3% annual growth, 7%, and 10%. Each one of these scenarios assumes a 4% annual return on reinvestments, and it includes our projected stamping fee revenues with the current stamping fee rate over that period. Now, the key takeaway here is that under all three scenarios, the gap between the undesignated fund balance and the maximum balance continues to narrow. So no scenario results in that gap widening, which reflects the ongoing impact of the reduced stamping fee rate working as intended. As I said previously, the main difference here is the timeline at which those numbers are converge on one another. Now, here's the slide that I've been alluding to the whole time that gets into the heart of today's discussion. So here I have modeled the next 10 years of the fund balance projections under three different scenarios. So what you'll see first, the green line is what we project over the next 10 years with the current 0.04% stamping fee rate. And the black line that you'll see is the 0.02% rate, with the one in the middle being this reducing our fee to 0.03%. Now, the modeling for each scenario rests on three key assumptions. So first is a 3% average annual growth rate in operating expenses. The second is investment income projections that was generously provided by our cross bank broker. So thank you for that, Alex, which is based on a 4% return on reinvestments from maturing securities. And third is that each scenario assumes that any rate change would be effective 1/1/27. And then the model also accounts for the typical 6-month lag before a rate change is fully reflected in revenue. And this is consistent with the dynamic that we discussed earlier regarding the realized rate. Now, first, the good news. Under every one of these scenarios that's modeled, the reserve balance does eventually reach the maximum threshold. And the variable that differs most meaningfully across scenarios is time. So how quickly we get there and how smooth or volatile that path is along the way. Now, first, I will touch on the 0.02% scenario. So while it's obvious that it does contribute in reducing that reserve gap significantly, a rate that low would almost certainly necessitate a subsequent increase at some point in the not too distant future. Now, this scenario also doesn't consider a material shift in expenses at any point over the next 10 years, which certainly could occur with any change in legislation or any other meaningful changes in how SLTX operates. Now, by contrast, the 0.04% scenario, so the current rate, this is the one that best mirrors the actual operating environment as it is currently in current market activity. So it's calibrated to run just slightly below the break-even rate, which keeps the reserve reduction on a measured, sustainable trajectory moving forward without falling so fast that it would require a subsequent increase thereafter. Of course, if premiums begin increasing beyond what's currently projected, then this could necessitate another reduction in the stamping fee rate to reduce those reserves meaningfully. And unsurprisingly, the 0.03% scenario sits in the middle of those two. So under this scenario, reserves could still be reduced to the maximum if premiums increase more than what's currently projected, but it also could necessitate a subsequent increase in the stamping fee rate if SLTX operations materially changes, or premium growth does continue to slow over a sustained period of time. Based off of everything that I presented today, my current recommendation is to take no action on the stamping fee rate at this time. Now, reported premium began showing signs of plateauing in mid-2025, and maintaining the current 0.04% rate supports the long-term stability goal for the stamping fee rate, avoiding the kind of oscillation that would occur if it was reduced to 0.02% and then needed to increase shortly thereafter. And I do want to touch on here that stamping fee rate increases or decreases both have a significant impact on our brokerage community. The 2025 stamping fee revenue also aligned very closely with what was projected, so that validates our modeling approach, and it also points to that even though stamping fee revenue did continue to, or I guess premiums increased last year, it didn't differ significantly from what we did project, so it wasn't unexpected. And as the reserve gap has also continued to decline over the previous 2 years, so this demonstrates that the strategy adopted 2 years ago with the current stamping fee rate is working. Now, of course, SLTX will continue to monitor market conditions and reserve levels closely and reassess the adequacy of the rate as the picture evolves. And if there's any significant changes in the market or if operations shifts materially, that will factor into our future analysis, and we will include that in our discussion next year. Now, with that, I want to thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone has.
I just wanted to make an observation, as we did at the F&A committee yesterday. As with all the other presentations, this was excellent, and you made a very difficult, complex situation easy for us to understand. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Are there any questions or further discussion? Mr. Robinson, do you have a recommendation for the board at this time?
I think it just have to be, yeah.
Mr. Brandon.
We recommend that we submit this analysis to the deputy commissioner as required by the plan of operation and recommend that the commissioner take no action regarding the stamping.
May I have a motion that at this point in time, we take no action as recommended by Mr. Brandon. Second, please.
Second.
Bishop, second. Thank you. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Okay, so that passes. Sorry, I had a few missing parts on my thing, so that's okay. Okay, agenda item 4, discussion and appropriate action, annual review of plan of operation and proposed amendment. I will turn the floor over to Mr. Klein, please.
I've been on the board for 5 years. This is the first time we've seen a Muppet animal, aka.
Hey, Ariel.
So it's a brief report. Item 4 in your agenda materials has information on the plan of operation. This board and the plan of operation committee before it reviewed some changes to the plan last year, many of them technical, most of them technical. A few substantive, such as requiring subcommittees to give advance notice of their meetings, and a requirement starting in 2027 for an odd year review of the plan of operation. And we're doing this all pursuant to Section 2C5B. So we have several members of the TDI who we work in partnership with us, Stephanie and David and Katie, and we welcome them here today. We made some recommendations on the plan of op. I understand that they're before the Texas Department of Insurance requiring final review, and we will proceed upon notice from TDI. So it's in progress, but I think nearing completion. That's my report. I'll take any questions if any.
Anyone have any questions? Okay, thank you. Mr. Klein, do you have any recommendations for us at this time?
No.
Okay, thank you. Agenda item 5, policy and intake analysis, director report, and appropriate action, policy and intake analysis update. Toby Pick, I will turn the floor over to you.
Well, good morning, everybody. Good morning. I was going to provide you a couple of updates so far this year. So we did send out a policy audit at the beginning of this year. Our ops team is currently pushing through, and we're almost done to the final stage of the process, which is called final review. We did select 34 different agents and 722 policies this go round. So that's something notable. Another thing that we did in February, we met with a small smart user group in February and had a collaborative and productive meeting and kept the conversation going. So we both had better understanding of each other and like what each other did. Very good meeting. Got a lot out of it. And then I really wanted to just let you guys know that on a monthly basis, I have deliverables that I send out to the Texas Department of Insurance. So on a monthly, quarterly basis, we generate and deliver reports to the Texas Department of Insurance, including the monthly late filing request for adjustments, outstanding and eligible report, and our policy and premium report. Then the next thing I'd like to talk about is late filings. So moving to slide 3, I'd like to walk you through our year-to-date late filing premium data for 2025. Mm-hmm. The total late filing premium was a little over $1.14 billion. And we can break that down across the year. January was our highest month at approximately $183.6 million. April followed as the second highest month at $160.5 million. And on the other end of that, June represented the lowest month in premium, which was $33.5 million. The operations team works with brokers and agents on a daily basis and reviews policies, many policies. And this gives us the opportunity to focus on reducing late filings overall and to improve compliance with all of the agents and brokers. And moving on to slide 4, I'd like to point out that the total 225 year-to-date late filing premium was, again, a little over $1.4 billion. But after research and coordinating with the Texas Department of Insurance, specifically with Andrew Guerrero, the actual 2025 annual late filing report showed only $736 million in late filed premium. So I feel like I just wanted to point out that this is TDI does a very good job and is willing to work with the brokers on the late filing topic while also requiring the timeliness of all of filings. And this is important to our operations. And last slide, I don't know if you guys remember, but we renewed our Lemon Light partnership. And I'd like to take a moment to express my appreciation to the board for approving the renewal of our Lemon Light partnership. Because this is where we use our SLTX training videos. This has been a truly valuable collaboration. The Lemon Light team has been not only professional, but also incredibly insightful in helping us evaluate the quality and effectiveness of our training content. I'd also like to extend a special thank you to Kathy and Chantel and the operations team. They played a key role in keeping this initiative moving forward. They also stepped into this new responsibility and are doing an outstanding job, and they've learned and grown in this space. As an example of the work coming out of this partnership, I'd like to highlight one of our training videos titled How to Delete a Transaction. So all of our training videos are available on our website, sltx.org, and they are actively being used by our smart users to support their day-to-day work and filings. And with that, I'd like to go ahead and share the video.
Pause it because the audio.
Yeah.
Huh. Share your sound. There's an option to share your sound.
Please hold.
You're sharing. Sure. My sound is all in. Might be the way you're sharing. Great.
I don't see it in here. Yes. Yes.
Let's restart.
This guide explains how to delete a transaction in Smart. From the broker landing page, select Filing and click Data Entry. This opens the Data Entry landing page. Here you can create new transactions, review recent filings, save confirmations as PDF, or search and edit filings. To delete a transaction, begin by clicking New Transaction. Select Delete, then choose the type of transaction you want to delete and click Next. Enter the policy number and effective date for the transaction you want to delete. Then click Search. Select the transaction from the results and click Next. Key data such as the named insured and policy number are automatically copied into your delete entry screen. No additional input is required. Click Delete to submit the filing to SLTX. If errors are detected, a notification will appear. Correct the errors, then click Delete again. Once the filing is accepted, a confirmation window appears. Continue by filing another type or finish filing to return to the broker landing page. Need more help? Contact the tech support team via email or phone.
So that about concludes my presentation. And like I always like to tell Greg, the operations team is operating.
That's good. Thank you, Mr. Pick. Are there any questions at this time? Mr. Pick? Do you have a recommendation for the board at this time?
I do not.
Thank you so much. We will move to agenda item 6, ITS Director and Appropriate Action, an ITS update. At this time, we have Shalonda Stone, Director of ITS, present the ITS Director update.
I'm going to be going over some smart updates. We have Microsoft AI project in connection with Microsoft. And then I'm just going to give some general updates of what's going on. So we have two releases still happening. The first release is 2506. What's listed on the screen is giving you an idea of what's in the release. There are some API filing adjustments, report changes, access to view stamping fee pay history, which was an outside request. We have limit exemption premium values not to exceed the premium file. So we had an issue with somebody inputting in some incorrect numbers. So we're doing some adjustments. And right now, currently, that's the status we have. We are down currently to 3 tickets that are still being worked. One is about to conclude. We have 2 tickets. So we're going to be wrapping up 2506 in approximately 2 to 3 weeks. And we are working on, in conjunction, 2601. 2601 mainly is focusing on updates and edits, which is a very big thing. It's something that we didn't have, and now we're trying to get it pushed out. This basically 2601 is going to be released in stages. It's not going to be like one huge big release, but we're going to release it over time in little chunks and bits and pieces. So that way, the stuff that's being worked on, it does not have to wait until full completion before people can actually start utilizing it. So that's a little bit different than what we normally do from what we're doing in 2601. So we started a Microsoft AI proof of concept project in October of last year. I wrote a grant for Microsoft. They had a competition and there was a little over 10,000 people. We're down to the final 3. They did some work to prove the concept to see if they could actually produce what we were asking.
And right now, we are pretty much in a good spot. They still have not made a decision. They're still kind of hung up on the last three people. I don't know what they're going to do to proceed, but the final end of the grant is they're going to basically support the project for the ongoing life of the project with no additional cost or fee to the person that won the grant. So that's what the final competition is for. If not, it's not a bad thing. They've done work already for us. The good thing is if we don't get picked, we can still finish development internally. If we do get picked, then they would finish the development for us. So that's a plus. So we're just kind of in limbo, kind of waiting. We started another, I wrote another grant that we do today. It's already turned in. And that's for a different part of an AI project that we're working with them. So hopefully we get that approved. I think we have a good point of getting that approval. We'll work with the same team that we use for this grant. Go to the screen article. So the grant basically focuses around COVID-19 and helping them with policy audits, because that is one of their biggest pain points. Whenever they go out to do policy audit, they ask their brokers and agents for policies. Whenever they're being sent in, some of them are missing pieces, and it's taking policy audit longer and dragging it out for completion. The checklist is, I think, Toby, you send it out. Your team sends it out. So Toby's team send the checklist out whenever they ask for policies for the policy audit for the set that they're requesting. So I took that information from what Toby team had, and I gave all the data points over to Microsoft. We gave them some dummy data to work with and asked them to make it work. This was a learning curve for them because they had to understand exactly what we were asking for, because most of them that were working on the project never really worked on insurance policies. So explaining what we needed to them was the biggest hurdle. And they did a pretty phenomenal job getting it done, considering where we are right now. So the data points collected was risk location, name insured, policy period, effective date, expiration, producer, insurer, policy number, premium, syndicate, total gross, tax, stamping fee, policy fee, sorry, and limit. And then three things we asked for were true or false. So we wanted to know, was the guaranteed fund present? We wanted to know, was a complaint notice present? And we wanted to know, was a DSLI fund present in each policy that submitted back to the office? Microsoft went a little bit above and beyond what we originally wrote in the grant, because the grant was, give me a yes or a no, or true or false, of whether all the data points are present. They actually were able to pull in the data points, so we actually have live data to look and review and double check, which kind of put us in a different point of how can we use this. So that's what I'm excited about. So we'll see how the second part of this grant goes with Microsoft. Hopefully, fingers crossed, we get it. I don't know. Greg is like, it's okay if we don't. So it's kind of mixed feeling whether we do or we don't. If we don't get it, we're still going to work on it and continue to develop it in-house. So it's been time-saving for our development team, because they don't have to sit and try to figure this out. We tasked Microsoft to do that. The last 3 weeks of the original proof of concept that they put out, because Microsoft put a hard deadline on their developers to actually create a proof of concept to get this working. We had 12 developers. They were working almost 24-hour shifts then for 3 weeks to get it completed. So it was a lot of time put in. Mind you, they started in December, and I think we got the final, well, not the final, but a hard like proof of concept in the end of February. So they put some time in on it. That was thankfully not our developers having to do it. They can continue to focus on farm. That's pretty much that. Did anybody have any questions?
Do we have, or does TDI have, like an AI governance policy in place yet? As we start to deploy more of these tools? I'm just thinking around privacy and security.
Not yet. I'm developing one, so we don't have one just yet. There's one in rough draft. so we can start to use it internally. All of our tools that we're developing is actually hosted on our domain, so it's not publicly accessible. It's not outside. That's one thing that I am really strict on when we come to using AI tools, that everything is controlled internally for us. So, but yes, I am developing a governance or a policy board.
That's great. Thank you.
Kudos to you. I mean, just the whole grant, getting it through, lots of work. I mean, I'm sure with the whole team, but kind of get chills. It's been awesome. Just Greg telling and sharing how great it is and information that's picking up on it.
Yeah, and I got to thank Ariel's on the phone and Dalton's on the phone. They've been doing a lot of the back end testing. Let's see, you know, to proving to whether it works. It's still a tool, so we're still basically teaching it what we need to teach it. Microsoft gave us a good jump of starting it, so we're now teaching it like the little granule things that probably Microsoft wouldn't have understood to do. So that's what we're doing internally for us, is literally we got to keep developing it. Even though they started it, we're continuing internally. Pretty exciting.
It is. If there are no other questions, Ms. Stone, do you have a recommendation for the board at this time?
Ma'am, I do not.
Thank you so much for your presentation. Agenda item 7, Executive Director Report and Appropriate Action, Review and Approval of Annual Report and Company Update. I will open the floor to Mr. Brandon to present the Executive Director Update.
All right. Thank you, Leslie. So the first thing we're going to do is go over the annual report. So I don't know why I presented it. Marissa puts all of this together. I have no idea why I own this, because she owns it top to bottom, tip to stern. So everything that's good about this document was done by Marissa. A lot of the data and the math came from Christian. And so I had very little to do with this. So please, if you think it's a beautiful document that is worthy of sending to TDI, that was not me. That was primarily Marissa, and Christian had a hand in all the data as well. But I will present it, and then maybe next year I'll make her do it. Because she's the one that actually creates this, and she deserves the credit for this document. It is really well done, quite frankly. So first page of this document tells you why we're doing it. So on the left-hand side, you see kind of the summary of the surplus lines stamping office of history. And then over on the right-hand side is really what is required. So you can see this comes from section 36F of the plan of operation. And it says it requires an annual summary of operations containing information on transactions, conditions, operations, and investments during the preceding year, and that has to be submitted to the Deputy Commissioner of Financial Regulation Division as part of the annual requirement for the annual meeting. So this is all part of the plan of operation requirements, and Marissa is the one that makes it look pretty instead of just a spreadsheet, which is what it would look like if I did it. First thing here, this page is all transactions. So I'll give you a little bit of history too. So there's going to be more to it than just, because we went so deep into the operations yesterday as part of the orientation. I'm going to skip a lot of that in my next presentation. So I'll add a little color to what's already on here to kind of help everybody understand what 2025 looked like. Because in my presentation, it's going to be all 2026 stuff. So when we're talking about transactions, you can see the lines of business, the premium, and the as aggregated by coverage. And not dissimilar to previous years, it is still mostly commercial liability and property that is filed with us on any given year. So liability and property combined is about 76%. And then if you go to the fourth one down on the left-hand side, commercial multi, so if you add that to it, you're talking about nearly 86% of everything that gets filed with us is commercial property and casualty. And then everything else kind of falls in the middle. So you can see auto. In the stamping office world, there's a lot of, or maybe in the surplus lines world, there's a lot of discussion about auto. So we just met with the folks at WSIA earlier in the week, and WSIA is getting a lot of questions about auto liability insurance. And so you might see some additional questions that come either nationally or from the state regarding auto. And I don't think it's unique in Texas to say that there is quite a bit of commercial auto. It's not unique to Texas. There's other states that are doing this. The personal lines market in auto is a little bit different. It does happen in Texas, but it is not really for you and I. You and I can't go to the surplus lines market for, call it, normal automotive insurance. But if you or I decided to take our new BMW 540i Coda track gathering and wanted to run three laps on the Coda track, you would have to buy that insurance from the surplus lines market. The admitted market won't cover it. So if you have any racing ideologies for any BMW or non-BMW products, if you wanted to do it on a track, the Coda track would make you have insurance, and that insurance would come from a surplus lines carrier. So it is very rare overall, but it does happen in the state of Texas. And I think that is relatively unique. I don't think a lot of states have that or even allow that. But personal lines auto does happen in Texas for very specific reasons, not just kind of in general for you and I to get back and forth to HEB. That does not happen. Then the other one is homeowners. You can see there on the bottom left-hand side that homeowners is up 56%. It has now has larger premium volume than credit or marine for the first time. And then this is talking about premium, but when you get to transactions, 87% of all new policies were residential in 2025. So that was a significant growth in the residential market. Now, the word, the term for us, residential, includes more than just homeowners, but homeowners is a part of residential. And as you can see, homeowners grew significantly from 2024 to 2025. So on the next page, it's another kind of summary of transactions. It really goes together with page six. So we'll kind of commit this to memory, right? What this is, it's to help TWIA, the Texas Windstorm Insurance Association, do some of their work and analysis. And so this is insurance associated with property only. So it's only the property insurance. And help me if I get this wrong, Christian. It's only property insurance, and it's percentage and premium that have an associated admitted carrier market to their firm. So it's a little bit different than sometimes what TWIA asks for. So TWIA has a membership base, and it is generally all the admitted markets that write property in Texas. But I don't know enough about TWIA to tell you specifically that it is the exact one-for-one match. So what we do, what Christian does, is puts this together, and this is all, and you'll see there's an explanation on a couple of pages in that talks about this. But this is done really for TWIA analysis, and it's part of the transaction information that is provided to the folks at TDI so that everybody's on the same page with regards to what the Windstorm Association needs from us. TDI has it as well.
So would that be like when you say it has a admitted like a Chubb and it's a...
Correct. So Westchester is the non-admitted arm of Chubb, right? So that's really what it is. So the Westchester, whatever Westchester is riding on property would be involved in this.
Okay.
So it's really a little bit of a deeper discussion for TWIA that we're working on. So maybe in this June meeting, we'll have a better update on TWIA because there was some recent changes legislatively in the TWIA, help me Christian, section 2210 is the insurance code that governs TWIA operations, and 2210 had some updates that require us to do some additional analysis. Now, that doesn't really have anything to do with what's in this particular document, but we're working on that right now. So maybe in June, we'll probably share that as an update. But anyway. So moving on, speaking specifically about transactions, you can see the stamping office processed 1.4 million surplus lines filings and a record 18.2 billion in premium. And those are increases of 8% and 9.8% reflectively. So you can see the growth, and you'll see the continued growth, particularly in transactions, as we move on to 2026 data in just a few minutes. So page six, this is an interesting slide. I think we'll give Christian full credit for this one. This is, there's a lot of effort here.
There's numbers.
Poor Marissa doesn't want to own this slide, I can promise you. This is a lot of work to put together that really kind of shows graphically kind of the same information that you saw two pages ago. And really what it's telling you is the industry hubs of Texas, Harris County, Dallas County, Travis County, Tarrant County, and Bexar County are all kind of the hot spots of total premium property. Underwritten by surplus lines, insurers with an admitted affiliate. And you can see, if you look down at the very bottom of it, you see the plan section that requires this, 3D1E6. So there's a lot to it. It's kind of an interesting thing to put together, but it does have kind of a specific purpose that is unusual. So when you're looking at it, if you don't read all of the notes and understand what it's for, you might misinterpret it as all property and mm-hmm. things like that. And that's not necessarily the case. So moving on to page seven, more information on transactions. This is something we typically do, right? Top 10 insurers on the top and top 10 brokers on the bottom. I think for us, I think there's no surprise that Lloyd's is the largest, but it's also important to point out that Lloyd's is a marketplace, not a single carrier. So there are 107 Lloyd's syndicates that write surplus lines. They're eligible to write surplus lines in Texas. So Lloyd's is an all-encompassing number, and that's one of the reasons why they dominate the premium number every year compared to everybody else. The other thing I'll point out is there are 319 total eligible surplus lines insurers, and that's counting Lloyd's as one. So 319 in 2025, we added 20 new eligible insurers, and there were four that were made ineligible. And there are two that are still in situ. So if you go back to yesterday when we were talking, when Amy was giving her presentation about determining eligibility of carriers, there's a lot of kind of effort in analyzing finances for the eligibility of a carrier. And there's a lot of back and forth between the three organizations. So the carrier involved, TDI, and the stamping office all have a piece in that puzzle to put together to determine eligibility and maintain eligibility. So there's a lot of effort that goes into that. And on the bottom, I'm sorry.
I'm gonna ask you a question on that. So those that dropped, were they, it wasn't really due to the 15 million requirement that we have, right? It was just maybe liquidation or some things like she brought up yesterday.
I'm not sure about liquidation. Usually what happens when they stop, they have just stopped writing surplus lines in Texas. And okay. So they just say it's no longer worth our time to continue to provide you. I don't think we've won insolvency.
Insolvency?
Yeah. 2018.
Yeah. So it doesn't happen very frequently in this market. So it's rarely a solvency issue.
Okay.
It's usually just a risk appetite. They no longer have the appetite to write whatever they were writing state.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
And then on the bottom, you can see the top 10 brokers. So the large wholesalers, obviously, no surprise who's on the top 10 list for brokerage. But I think it's probably just as important to point out the bigger number there. You see on the lower left-hand corner, 1,013 brokers filed with us last year. So in our mind, we have 1,013 customers. And you can see everything, the total number of transactions, right? 1.4 million. And so for us, we're relatively indifferent to size. It doesn't really matter if you're the largest or the smallest or anywhere in the middle. You're going to get the same level of service out of our organization regardless. So to us, this top 10 thing is great. If you know brokers, all brokers are competitive. They all want to be the largest broker on the planet. And I don't blame them. That's part of the business, right? So business is improving for a lot of them. So they like to see these top 10 lists. But for us, we don't put a lot of emphasis on top 10. For us, it's more we have over 1,000 customers that we have to work with in any given year. And they all get the same level of service. And then this final page is the kind of the last of it. And you can see this is kind of a written description of the FIA information on the top on the conditions. It's it tells you what it's for, and it's a historical request. It's the historical norm for TWIA. They need this for managing their stuff. TDI needs it as well, so we put it together on their behalf. And then finally, the last piece of the puzzle is the financial summary, and really that's just everything that Frost Bank and Calhoun have talked about in the last couple of minutes. So all the same kind of information year over year. This is all required by the plan of operation, and Marissa makes it look good for everybody. It's a nice restful. So that concludes my report on the annual report.
Okay.
I do have a recommendation.
Okay.
I recommend the board approve the report as presented and that we submit it to TDI in accordance with the plan of operation.
Motion on the floor. Accepted.
Motion.
Second.
I'll second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion passes, and thank you, Mr. Brandon, for that presentation. Okay, so we will move to agenda item 8, election. Am I missing it?
Oh, I still have my update.
Okay.
Real quick, I promise.
Sorry about that.
Sorry.
Okay.
Okay, so. I'll
work on the script thing because it's.
Moving on, so this is just like I told you, I kind of gave you an embellished or an expanded version of 2025 as part of that review, but I'll go into 2026 real quickly, right? We've only got 2 months of data to share because March isn't over yet. So you can see the blue bars are all the previous years, and then the orange or yellow line is 2026. So premium wise, we're at $2.5 billion. January was 1.4. And February was 1.16. So nothing really remarkable there. It's kind of it really does kind of align with what Christian's already told you. What we're seeing is the growth in premium is no longer as rapid as it once was. So everything seems to be kind of flattening out. Now there may be some anomalies next month that make it look different, but for now, with the January and February data. Right now, premium is relatively flat compared to year over year for the year. Now you move on to item count, and this is where things get interesting. So you can see it is rare when it comes to item count that I have to change the scale of the y-axis. but for January, we certainly did. There's a kind of an interesting story there. So what I'll probably do, rather than focus on the item count, let's just move straight to the next slide, and we'll go to policy count, because policy count is where so just to remind everybody, policy count and item count are related. Policies are part of item count, but there are other things that come in with a policy that count as an item that are not the policy itself. So there's a lot of different things that come in, endorsements, even cancellations would count. So there's a lot of things that come in associated with the policy that are not the policy itself. But we'll move on to the next slide and talk about the policies themselves, because this is where the really remarkable data occurs. So we had a very unusual start to 2026. You can see January was completely off the charts with regard to policy count. So it went from, call it the historical norm, is somewhere in that 55,000 policy range for January, and it was off the charts at 104,000. This is largely attributable to CGL policies. And two-thirds of those policies were new tenant dwelling policies. And the interesting part about that is over 28,000 of them were from one company. And we think, where Christian and I have done a lot of speculating about this, we think they're done for the year. If you look at their historical, this is well beyond their historical norm for filing, but they go many, many months without filing anything and then just kind of load everything in 1 month. And so we think they do this all at once, and then I don't know what happens for the remainder of the year. With their organization, but
I think they had none in February.
Yeah. So that's exactly right.
They filed, like a property management company or something.
Yeah, that's
doing like a forced place.
Probably. So Yeah, so to talk about the policies themselves, probably inappropriate, but yeah, you're right. I mean, it is likely short-term dwelling. And, you know, I don't want to name any names, but I think everybody knows people that rent their houses out for a day or two. And we think that's what it is. And we have requested from that broker some additional information because it is so unusual to have one broker. And the other thing is they're not late. You know, if you have 28,000 things land on our desk, it's because someone forgot to file 10,000 of them. 3 months ago or 4 months ago. That is not the case. It was less than 200, I think. Very low number that are actually late. So just a very unusual circumstance that we've never seen before in our organization. For us, just the ability to digest that number of things is really pretty remarkable. So from an organizational standpoint, while it's all kind of strange to look at and say, wow, January was the weirdest January we've ever had. Quite frankly, our systems and our people digested all of that without issue. We had not really any problems for us. And for me, from running the business standpoint, that's the more important thing to point out is even though January was double the norm, didn't affect us at all organizationally. So, well, I say that. Toby's team may disagree. but, you know, on the whole, we were able to digest all of those submissions without much complaint. So, and then.
Yeah,
that's right. Operations is operations.
That's right.
and that concludes my report. Since I did so much yesterday on the organization,
omitted it all. Okay. So I have one question on like item count. Is that sometimes like if it were a CGL and they added not an endorsement, but maybe like a marine policy to it too? Do they have attachments like that to it or is it?
Well, an endorsement would be the easier, right? It might be a separate, kind of depends, but could be either a separate policy or it might be if it is a true endorsement, mm-hmm. then it would just be.
So if they wrote a 10 vehicle policy, commercial auto, would that be 10 items on that policy, or is that just?
If it's all filed at once, probably not. But what happens with large automotive, right? Use a dealership. Their numbers fluctuate monthly. Do they report more than monthly? I'm not aware of anyone who reports more than monthly. But generally speaking, you'll have. I'm making these numbers up, but let's say there's 10,000 cars in January. There might be 8,000 cars in February, 12,000 cars in March, and those get filed with us every month. So it just kind of comes and goes. So that's actually a very easy one to point out because automotive in particular, commercial automotive mm-hmm. for dealerships and some like garage stuff like that can massive fluctuations month over month. So there's all sorts of endorsements. And, right. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Does anyone have any further questions for Mr. Brandon? Time? If not, Mr. Brandon, do you have a recommendation for the?
I do not.
Okay. Now we will move to agenda item number 8, election of 2026 officers. We have 3 officer positions to elect, chair, vice chair, and secretary. We'll handle these separately to record the nominations and to vote on the nominees for each position. If there are more than one nominee for any of the officer positions, the nominee with the most votes will be elected to the respective position. Officer terms are for 1 year and will commence upon election. Our first position is secretary. With the assistance of the stamping office staff, the secretary must keep full minutes of the proceedings of the board and perform other duties customary to the office or assigned by the chair. Do I have any nominees for the office of secretary?
Make myself.
So we have Leah. So we have any other nominations? All in favor of Leah Bennett, please raise your hand. Let the record reflect. that, how many board members did we have there? Five board members voted in favor of electing,
you.
And having the most votes, you are now elected as Secretary of the Stamping Office Board of Directors. Vice Chair. Vice Chair performs all duties of the Chair during the absence of the Chair. Do I have any nominees for the office of Vice Chair?
Nominate Jim Bishop.
Okay. Do we have any other nominations? All in favor, Mr. Jim Bishop, please raise your hand. The record reflect that five board members voted in favor of electing Mr. Jim Bishop for Vice Chair. Okay. In the most votes, Mr. Jim Bishop, you're elected as Vice Chair of the Stamping Office Board of Directors. The Chair. The Chair will preside at all meetings and perform all duties customary to the office, including the appointment of committees. The Chair is an ex officio member of all committees and signs certain contracts as established in board policies. Do I have any nominees for the office of Chair?
Nominate Leslie.
I'm going to do it if no one wants to do it. Ryan? No. I know his wife's going to kill him if we do. So you want to wait a minute or?
Just a minute, yeah.
Okay.
You won't.
This is a little awkward for me. I always are there any other nominations? All in favor of Leslie Lilgenberg, please raise your hand.
Aye.
Let the record reflect that five board members voted in favor of electing Leslie Lilgenberg. Having the most votes, Leslie Lilgenberg is elected as Chair of the Standing Office Board of Directors. I'm proud to announce our new officers of the Board of Directors of the Surplus Line Stamping Office of Texas for 2026, Chair Leslie Lilgenberg, Vice Chair Jim Bishop, Secretary Bennett. Congratulations to all. And with that, I'll turn the floor over to our newly elected chair. Okay. To preside over the remainder of the meeting. Okay. Next agenda item is the appointment of committee members. Under Section 2C9A of the Stamping Office Plan of Operation, the chair's duties include the appointment of committees. Each committee is governed by a charter which provides for the membership, terms of the members, and that the board chair will serve as an ex officio member and may appoint the chair of each committee. So we'll have committee appointments at this time. Do I have someone that would like to volunteer to be finance and audit, to be in charge of the finance and audit committee? Need a chair.
I'll do it.
Okay. Nick Lawrence, I need two members, please.
I'll volunteer to be a member.
Okay.
I'll volunteer.
And Leah. Okay. Thank you. Next committee is board training committee. I need a chair and two members, please.
Also, a reminder, you've got two board members who are not here.
Oh, that's true.
So you are welcome to designate them as chair of the board. Me. You can.
Ooh, sure. No. Does anybody present want to be in charge of the training committee? And we might add that staff really does do.
And I'm happy to do that.
Does that work? Okay. Thank you, Jim. And two committee members there?
Sir.
Yeah. And I think Jason would be great. All right. And then we need a plan of operation committee chair.
Pete. I'll agree to chair it again if no one wants it.
Okay.
I'll volunteer for it. Yeah,
if you want to be chair, right?
Had this to say, he's got a lot on his plate. Okay, so who? And then we've got Pete not on a committee yet. And are we missing anybody on a committee?
Not everybody.
Jeff Ryan. Well, reminder, we have one open position as well, okay. So there's going to have to be some overlap. So
okay.
So when we get a new member, you could certainly swap them out.
Swap them out for that. Okay, sounds good.
I want to chair the committee on committees if we have one. I can do.
Okay. Agenda number 10, adjournment. There being no other business before the board, do I hear a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Have a second?
Second.
Yeah. Thank you. All of those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes have it. This meeting is adjourned at 10:34 a.m. on March.